Session number 11904, Lieutenant Commander HJ Instance, Reel 2.
Mr. Joe Instance, Reel 2.
The noise was terrific. One can't imagine what was happening inside the ship. All the 6-inch ready-use shells probably were falling off their racks and thundering themselves around the ship, all loose lockers and things must have been moving and falling everywhere. You could even hear the 15-inch shells, one-ton shells, coming out of their racks and boom, 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 bounding around the magazine of the shell room. It was awful to listen to. And then everything went quiet. You could hear voices, people yelling and some screaming. And then gradually the hull just disappeared and you've got vents of air and water coming up, and then it was gone. And I thought, right, I've got out. I've got a blooming well float now. And away, about half a mile away, was the tender. We had a tender called Daisy 2 that used to get our mail and take the Liberty men ashore. And she, apparently, had just got back to the ship just before these explosions took place. And when the ship started going over, they had to cut the wires so she wouldn't go over with it. And she sort of backed off from the ship, and Skipper Gatt was the man. He saved about, over 200 men milling around the water. I couldn't see very many people. As I say, it was terribly dark. And I was beginning to feel the cold. And then a voice out of the darkness said, who's that? And I recognised my divisional officer, Lieutenant Hall. And I said, it's Leading Seaman Instance, and I'm burnt to buggery. Oh, he said, sorry, old man, hang on to this lump of wood. And we had a plank between us. And I recovered a bit then. And then he said, look, he said, that large light over there, he said, is the Daisy. Come on, let's swim for the Daisy. Well, he was all right. He was uninjured, you see. But I went off with him, left the log, went off with him, and I could only make about 100 yards. And then it was just a question of surviving, keeping myself afloat. And then out came the oil. Oh, it was about 2 inches thick. It was like trying to swim in treacle. And I thought, my God, I'm not going to swallow any of this, because I'd heard stories before, people swallowing oil and getting ulcers and having their stomach burned. And I thought, I've got to keep my head above. I must not swallow oil. So I just dog paddled around. And I could hear a few voices in the distance singing Dame Mexico Way. I tried to sing Dame Mexico Way, but I didn't know the words anyway. And I suppose I floated around for about half an hour or more, and my sole motive was keep afloat. Having got out of the ship, I wasn't going to drown. That was my whole attitude. And then I heard a voice, two voices in the darkness, and I heard somebody say, a young voice it was, in fact it was one of the boys, say, there's one over here, sir. And over came this little raft. It was no more than about 4 foot square, the sort of raft they used to touch up the black boot topping right round the bottom of the ship. And on it was this boy, Lawrence, and the commissioned shipwright officer. And they had one paddle. And I heard the shipwright officer say, righto, pull him in. And, of course, this poor boy couldn't pull me in because he couldn't get hold of me. I was smothered in oil. So the shipwright officer said, right, get hold of his hair and drag him in. Well, I didn't have any hair. It was gone. It was burnt off. And so they tried to grab hold of my hands. And, of course, I screamed out because my hands were raw. And finally, they got me under the armpits and sort of just slid me on. And I laid on this thing. And I remember thinking they've only got one paddle, so I better help them. And I remember paddling with my hand, and then I went out. I don't remember anymore. And the next thing I remember was being hoisted up the gangway of the Pegasus by two able seamen. And we got to the top of the gangway, and the officer watch was there. And of course, my trousers and jersey, although it saved my body from being burned, it was all charred and falling off. And I heard the officer watch say, right, strip off all that charred stuff and undo that belt and sling it over the side. And my brain clicked, because Friday, the day previously, we'd been paid. And I had £5 in the belt of the pocket. So I said, well, I've got my fortnight's pay in there. They said, all right, put a blanket round him and put the belt round the outside of the blanket and then take him down to sick bay. So they walked me along the deck, and on the deck were rows of bodies. And I said, well, what's all that? They said, oh, those the dead ones we picked up. They died of exposure. And I thought, good God, is that what's going to happen to me? Anyway, they took me down to the sick bay, which was very small, only about 8 by 10, I suppose, with two bunks in it. And there were several chaps down there who had been burnt. Anyway, they laid me on the bunk and poured, I think it was martini, poured down my throat. And then the sick berth attendant said, would you like a cigarette? And I said, yes, please. And he put a cigarette in my mouth, and I took a puff, and when he took the cigarette away, my lips came away with it. And it so shocked me that I went unconscious again. The next recollection I've got is being helped down the gangway. Oh, no, I remember being sprayed with tannic acid, and the chap saying, we're spraying you with tannic acid, and that'll keep you until you get to the hospital ship. And I was taken down with about 20 other people who'd been burnt onto another drifter. But this drifter wouldn't move from the Pegasus to the hospital ship, which was the other end of the floe. He wouldn't move until daylight. And there we sat in this hold, shivering. And, of course, the burns were beginning to really hurt. But daylight, about 5, 6 o'clock, he took us down to the hospital ship, which was about 5 or 6 miles away, and we were hoisted in by cradle and crane and put into the big sick bay there, where they had everything, the nurses and orderlies, and they really looked after us. And the first thing they did was, of course, gave you a shot of morphia, which puts you straight out. And during that time, of course, they were dressing the wounds, and I came to. And I couldn't see very well. I could only sort of see in front of me. And I couldn't understand why. And I turned my head and looked at the chap next to me. And he was bandaged all the way over with just two holes for his eyes and a hole for his mouth. And I said, do I look like you? And he said, yes. Oh, dear, oh, dear. And my hands were all bandaged up on hanging up like this. And we spent 2 days on the hospital ship. And the next day, overcame the bombers. Well, the only target worth bombing, of course, was the Iron Duke, which was a depot ship, an old battleship acting as a depot ship. And the hospital ship wasn't very far from the Iron Duke. And they were coming in and laying their line of bombs down, trying to hit the Iron Duke, and they were falling very, very close to the hospital ship. In fact, one string of bombs sort of lifted the hospital ship up and dropped it back in again. And we all thought, oh dear, we're not going to have to swim again. But finally, they did hit the Iron Duke, and she had to be beached on one of the islands. And finally, they went off, and the next day we sailed for Invergordon. And when we got to Invergordon, they cleared a small hospital, children's hospital, took the children away somewhere else, and I think there were about 25 of us burned, and we were the sole patients in that hospital. And I was in there, I was the last one to leave. I was in there until the day before Christmas. And it took them about 5 weeks of cleaning 3 times a day with some sort of spirit. I don't quite know what it was. But they had to clean off the oil from the wounds before they could do any operations at all. And it took, as I say, nearly 5 weeks. And they had a trolley. They used to come up morning, afternoon and evening. And for the first fortnight, they, as they arrived, they would give you a shot of morphia. And then they would start cleaning up. And it was very, very painful. But this trolley had a squeaky wheel. And you could always hear it coming. You dreaded hearing that wheel. And I said to the sister one day, I said, why don't you oil that damn wheel? They did. And after about 5 weeks, the surgeon came to see me. And he was from Harley Street, called up for the war. And he'd had quite a bit of skin grafting experience. So, you know, it was a blessing in disguise. And he said, right, we're going to take the skin off your thigh, this one, and we're going to skin graft your hands and parts of your face, your nose, you know, where the... with this huge flame, anything protruding like a nose, it just sort of took it off. And so I said, well, you're going to put me right off. He said, oh, yes, right. And anyway, I was taken down, and when I came to, I was bandaged up again, and this hand, only the left hand was small bandage, but this right hand was like a great big leg of mutton, and it was hanging up on a crane. And I was told I wasn't to move it, but after about 3 days, it began to smell rather badly. And when I used to go to sleep, this thing used to swing in right under my nose, and I used to have to push it out of the way. And the next day I told the doctor about this, and he said, I don't want to move the bandages because otherwise the skin graft will not take. He said, don't worry about the smell. He said, we'll keep an eye on the temperature, and if your temperature doesn't go up, we'll leave it. He said, I want to leave it for 10 days. So I said, well, look, can you tie it to the fella's bed, next bed? I said, because I keep swinging in. Of course, you can imagine the chap next door was saying, I don't want it tied to my bed. And after about 10 days, it was awful. I thought to myself, I've lost this hand. The smell was awful. And they took me down to the end ward and put the screens round, and the sister came in and started taking off all these bandages and cotton wool. And the more she took off, the stronger the smell got. And after about 5 minutes, she said, excuse me a moment. And she went out and came back about 5 minutes later, and I said, what's the trouble? She said, well, I just had a glass of brandy. So I said, look, I've been smelling this for 10 days. What about my brandy? So she very kindly went and got me a glass of brandy. Well, when they finally got everything off, including the oil cloth, which was laid on first, it was a shocking mess. And I really thought my right hand was going to come off. And the doctor came along and he said, right, aquaflavine. And I'd never heard of this stuff before, but it's like piccalilli sauce, yellow, very thick yellow sauce. And they smothered the whole of the wrist and the hand with it and just lightly bandaged it. And the next day they took it off, and I've never seen anything like it in my life. It was as clean as a piece of rump steak. Beautiful to look at. And he examined it and said, oh yes, look, there's a piece taken there and there's a piece taken there, and on your knuckles it's taken and on the end of the fingers. And he said, don't worry, he said, all those pieces of skin will grow together. And I suppose it was about another 10 days before he would let me, even think of letting me come home. But I had to wear special white gloves. I couldn't have them out in the air, and I had to be very careful I didn't knock them. And my wife came. I was on the danger list for about 3 weeks, and they sent for my wife, and she was put out by a very kindly Scots woman just outside the hospital, and she used to come and visit me daily. But of course she didn't know me, because we'd grown big moustaches and beards, and they did manage to get the beard off. It was a very painful business. They got the beard off, but they wouldn't touch the moustache because the top lip hadn't healed. And of course, my wife came waltzing in the ward and walked straight past me until I called out. But they looked after her very, very well indeed. and I couldn't wear a uniform. I couldn't get a uniform on, so she brought out some civilian clothes for me. And we had a shocking 36-hour journey from Invergordon to Portsmouth. All night long, full of soldiers and sailors. We stopped at one big station, I can't remember it now, about 9 o'clock at night. And my wife said, I'll go and get a cup of tea. And she went out and came back. She said, I can't get near the counter. Full up with soldiers and sailors. And in our compartment, we had 3 soldiers and 4 sailors. Anyway, good souls they were. I thought, well, I'll have to go without a cup of tea. But 5 minutes later, back came a sailor with 2 cups of tea. Then another sailor came back with 2 cups of tea. And a soldier came back with 2 cups of tea. And we had cups of tea lying across the carriage floor, more than we could really drink. We got to London, and I was starving. And I said to my wife, I really must have something to eat. I said, but I'm not going to take my hat off, because you're completely bald. And I had no eyelashes, no eyebrows. I said, we're going to go somewhere where I can keep my hat on. I said, I know. I said, down the bottom of the slope from the entrance of Waterloo Station, I said, there's a porter's cafe. Now, they won't mind. And we went down there, and we had sausage and mash and bread and butter. It was marvellous. Real good food. And, of course, they were all sitting there with their caps on, you see, so it didn't make any difference that I had a trilby hat on. And then we got the train down to Portsmouth, and I reported at the naval barracks gates, as you can imagine, in civvies, and the regulating petty officer said, yes, what do you want? I said, I'm a Royal Oak survivor. He said, rubbish, they've been and gone. I said, no, honestly, I'm a Royal Oak survivor. Where's your identity card? I said, what's the bottom of the scapa flow in my diddy box? I mean, all my stuff was there, you see. And he finally sent for the officer watch, and I had to explain all this to the officer watch, and he said, why aren't you in uniform? I said, I can't wear uniform. I can't get it on. I said, burnt hands, burnt face and burnt neck. Oh, well, he said, look, it's Christmas Eve. He said, you might just as well push. Do you live locally? I said, yes. I lived in Tangier Road then with my mother. He said, your best plan is to go home, have Christmas and New Year at home and come back after New Year, which is what I did. And then I was about light duty for about 6 months then. The surgeon commander used to see me about 3 times a week, make sure everything was healing nicely. And then during that 6 months, I had about 4 or 5 draft ships to destroyers and escort vessels. And of course, the surgeon commander squashed them immediately. He said, this man's not fit for anything. And then finally one day he said, no, do you think you could go and get your uniform on? So I said, well, I'll have a try. And I had a struggle that weekend to get in there because, you know, the sailor's jacket is a very difficult thing to get in. And I had to put a white handkerchief around the back to stop the collar rubbing my neck. And I went in on the Monday morning and saw him, and he said, oh, good. He said, I've got a draft shirt here for you. He said, I think you might like this one. He said, but it's up to you. He said, it's to go to HMS Excellent, Wight Island, to go on course for gunner. That was for warrant officer. Do you think you can manage it? And I thought, well, it's now or never. I've got to get back into fighting trim somehow. So I said, yes, I'll go. And I went to Wight Island on a 9 months course. The only difficult part was the 4 weeks rifle drill on the parade, because I couldn't bend my hands properly. In fact, I can't bend that one any more than that. Now, this one's all right.
You can't bend the right-hand one?
I can only bend it that far. And I got through that somehow. But the remainder, of course, was a lot of theory, fire control, director control, stuff where you sat down and had lectures and just operated the machinery. It was nothing really heavy to move. Do you want me to go on from there?
Can I just stop you there? Have you totally recovered from the injuries now, except for what you said about being unable to bend the fingers of your right hand?
Well, I had. You see, I went on to serve as an officer until 1959 in numerous ships, carriers, cruisers, destroyers.
So you made a complete recovery?
Oh, yes. But about 4 years ago, I had an open ulcer came on my nose. And I saw a local doctor, and she tried lots of ointments. And in the end, she said, I think you better go to hospital. I went to hospital, and they said it was a rodent ulcer, probably cancerous. Anyway, they cut it out, and I went round with my nose plastered for about a week or more, which was very embarrassing, especially when I went down the local, because everybody wanted to know what the other chap looked like. And I went back to hospital, they took the plaster off and said, yes, it's healed nicely. And I said, well, funny enough, I said, I've got another lump coming up the side of the head. They looked at that, took a biopsy, said, come back next week. And that was cancer, skin cancer. And since then, I've had four operations on my face for skin cancer. Nose, side of the head, and both cheeks. And this one on this right cheek was of a different variety to the other cancers. I forget the word they use now. It was a bad cancer. And not only did I have to have it cut out, but I had to go to St. Mary's Hospital and have radiation treatment. And I have to go every 3 months to Alexandra Hospital when they check to see if there's anything else coming up. But touch wood, so far, I haven't had any trouble for the last 9 months.
And this is because of the royal oak burning?
Yeah, this was due to the cordite burning and then the oil.
One thing going back to the sinking of the royal oak, whenever I interview anybody about the sinking of a ship, people in the sea always seem to start singing. What do you think the reason for that is?
Well, I think one reason is to keep your spirits up. And if you're rather spread out, you can then swim towards each other. You know, any man in the sea, entirely on his own, feels very, very lonely indeed, almost forsaken. If you can chum up with a few more, I don't know, it's a much better feeling, because that's what I felt. I was miles from anybody, and I felt terribly lonely. In fact, I thought I was about the only one that was never going to be saved.
You said when that flash occurred, the chap next to you just went up. Mm. He was just completely burned, wasn't he?
Yes, he was only in a singlet and a pair of pants, and it was just like striking a match. But my trousers being wool, thick serge, and my service jersey being thick navy blue wool as well, it shielded me from that intense flame, although it was charred and burnt. In fact, you can see where the service jersey ended there, you see?
On your wrist.
Yeah.
There's a mark.
That's right. It was burnt from there, but from here up was protected by the jersey. And had I not got dressed, I would have been just like the chap in front of me. And had I not been on that class of ship for 2 years previously, as an able seaman, I would have lost myself in that darkness.
What do you feel about the German crew that was responsible? Do you have any animosity towards them?
Oh, no. I mean, they were doing their job. In fact, it was a very, very courageous thing to do that they did, to get in there, because I expect they thought they'd never get out once they got in. No, don't. And it was a courageous thing, a very daring and very courageous thing. And, you know, when you look back yourself, I mean, I did another 4 years of war after that, 4.5 years of war, and destroyers I were on, we put down submarines, and, I mean, there was about 50 men gone west, sunk with depth charges. So you can't really think badly of them. In fact, I think most of the survivors especially when they meet Herman. I mean, Herman is very friendly with all of us. Nobody bears him a grudge at all.
This is one of the U-boat crew who comes to your reunions. Yeah.
And he's just one of us. He comes to every reunion. He's never missed. And when we have our reunion, we have it the nearest date as possible to the actual sinking date. This year, it's the 11th, 12th and 13th. And because we all come from long distances, we make a long weekend of it. We have Survivor's Night and wives and sons and daughters, if you wish, down in the Royal Naval Club in Portsmouth. They give us the upper, what they call Jack Cornwall Bar. And we meet there at 7 o'clock, and we leave there about 11:30. Herman's there. He's one of the first to arrive. And then on Saturday morning, we go to the War Memorial at Sacy Common, and there are five or six plates there with the names of all the men, 833 men that went down. And we have a service there, and that's usually attended by a lot of people outside of survivors, you know, relatives, sons, daughters, and so on. And the association, Royal Oak Survivors Association, we buy I've got the fund, and I buy a big anchor, white anchor, blue ribbon, and a bunch of red roses. And Herman, he comes down every year, and he presents, puts a wreath down from seaman to seaman, from U-47 to Royal Oak. And I think this is unique in naval history. Up to about 3-4 years ago, the wife of Preen used to come over with some of the German survivors who live in Germany to our reunion, and she would lay the wreath on at the Royal Oak end of the memorial. But she's unfortunately dead now. But Herman always lays the wreaths from the U-47 to the Royal Oak, from seaman to seaman.
Can I go on to a later stage in your naval career when you were in the Atlantic, on the Atlantic convoys, mm-hmm. because I think that you served with HMS Witherington.
That's right, yes.
Can you tell me about what kind of a ship that was?
Well, she was an old V&W destroyer. They built a lot of these during the last war. And, of course, after the war, they started cutting down and cutting down. And there were, I suppose, close on 100 of these V&W destroyers up in Rosyth, I believe, on reserve. A lot of them were scrapped, of course. And they were all their names began with a V or a W. That's why they were known as the V&W class. And, of course, when the war started, they started calling in all the reserves and sending them up there to bring these ships forward for escort duties. And rather coincidence, when I was at Wade Island going through for Gunner, there was an air raid on Portsmouth, and the bombers were after HMS Ramillies. But astern of the Ramillies was HMS Witherington. And they missed the Ramillies, and they put a bomb straight through the stern of the Witherington. And they had to very quickly untie her, and a couple of tugs beached her on Whale Island. And when I used to do my rifle drill, and we used to go around the back of the drill shed for smoke at Stand Easy, there was this V&W stuck up on the island without a stern. And li-